The next case, we'll give people just a moment to slip out. The next case is State of Nebraska versus Andrew Williams. And Mr. Island is here representing the appellant. Mr. Island, you may proceed.
A trial court is not authorized to compel a criminal defendant to provide the opinions and factual basis of a witness's testimony. Not only are they not allowed to do it, it exceeded the scope of the request from the state. Their scope of request was that the witness should be barred because that wasn't provided, and instead the court came up with a relief that was not requested or authorized by statute.
Well, isn't a trial court entitled to give them lesser relief than what they asked for?
I think in a criminal discovery case, they're not. They are controlled under both Wood and Kinney specifically to the statutory request. And so only what's requested is only what can be required to be reciprocated.
Well, let's start right there. You're talking about a discovery issue.
Correct.
And I'm going to try to provide a little benefit to our audience here, so I apologize for that. But
I'm trying to get right to the point.
Generally, the statutes, if the defense, pursuant to statutory discovery, if a defense does not ask for a particular item of statutory discovery, then there is no right for the state to get reciprocal discovery as to similar items.
Correct.
Or evidence. Okay. So, in this case, the trial court allowed or ordered you to provide information regarding the defense's expert witness.
Correct.
Okay. And but that witness, although the defense did not ask for the witness's names from the prosecution,
right.
That name of that witness had been provided to the state. Is that correct?
An exhibit had been provided that had his name shortly before trial.
Was his curriculum vitae.
Right.
Okay. So once that happens, doesn't that change the scenario? Does it take it into other aspects of the discovery statutes? For example, you asked for all the reports and documents that the state had. Does that not give the state the right to ask, knowing that you are going to present an expert witness, does that not give the state the opportunity to ask for similar reports and information?
They could ask for similar reports. There were no similar reports. The judge required us to create some type of report that didn't exist. That's not authorized. In addition, it's not authorized to go through all the facts and basis for that report, all the information relied on. Basically, what they're saying is, like in the Kinney, do our job, tell the state exactly what way they're going to go, give them a point-by-point kind of review so that when you get to trial, they can be prepared for cross-examination, rebuttal, scoping their witnesses, all the issues they talked about in the Kinney case. And that's what I think makes it improper is, one, it exceeded. Two, just because they have a name doesn't mean that the judge then can create relief for the state to give them an outline of the defense's case.
And the judge gave three options, basically, correct? The judge gave the option, if there was a report, produce the report.
Correct.
Gave the state the option to depose, or for the defense to make the expert available for the state to talk to that expert. Or thirdly, provide the report. And I believe the language of that was provide a complete explanation of the subject matter upon which the expert would testify.
Correct.
All right. And there was no report, so no report was produced.
Correct.
There was no deposition taken.
Right.
You provided a one-paragraph document with regard, is my understanding, looking at the record, the one-paragraph document outlining some basic parameters of the testimony. Is that correct?
I forget how many paragraphs, but yeah, outlining kind of the parameters of the testimony and where we were getting the information that we would be relying upon for that testimony.
Did that one paragraph that was provided constitute a complete explanation of the subject matter upon which the expert will testify?
I think that it outlined what the subject was going to be.
Did it give any opinions of the expert?
It didn't give an opinion, I don't believe.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll let you proceed.
No, I mean, my objection comes is I don't believe the judge has the authority to even grant that much when it comes to this information, because, once again, you're trying to take it out of the statute, which has been made clear of what it's bound by. It's bound by the statute, bound by the request, and that request limits it. And the state then has their own duty to go forward and find information if that's what they desire. To do stuff. Their request was, judge, just kick the whole witness out. And that would not have been appropriate under the circumstances.
And that's not what the judge did.
I understand. But he did then make us disclose information about the witness and about his opinions that was improper as well.
So the state argues the error was harmless because no report was given, no deposition was taken, and they already knew that this person was going to testify about the reliability of the data master machine.
They may or may not have known. I don't know what they're... Dr. Bellotto is a pharmacologist. He's a statistician. There's a variety of things. Most likely that may have been. Although in Kinney, what they didn't say specifically that we don't know what they would have done. In this case, it was cause of problem because then the state threw a fuss when Dr. Bellotto wanted to give some information about what a blood alcohol was. We had to have a side conference. As we know, that can impact on how the jury looks at how the case is going. They also, we don't know how they prepared, how they would have prepared for a cross-examination knowing this specific information, just like in Kinney. I mean, you kind of go through all those seven or eight things. They're like, we can't send you back to square one. Because we know now these are all the things that they could have done. Whereas at least in Wood, we can say, send it back someone who doesn't know anything about this one witness. I think what they said was it was too much. And that's why we think it's a problem in this case, because it went beyond what was acceptable, and it went beyond the relief requested, and it went beyond the statute. I think that's where the problem is. And that's why we think that's an issue. If there's no more...
The state never called their own expert to rebut any of the opinions of Dr. Bellotto.
The question is, did they anticipatorily approach that? And well, Dr. Bellotto is a PhD and a PharmD. That doesn't mean that they're what they call experts in terms of the maintenance and operation of this machine. We're not called and prepared in anticipation of those issues because of how they were approached. I think Mr. Razzler was the one who'd been trained at the academy and put on all the information.
But these were police officers that had been trained how to run a machine.
Yeah, but they're still experts under this because they have specialized knowledge, and this machine was not a good machine. I mean, it had kept breaking down every month or two, and the 1 year it was being...
And all of that evidence came in.
That evidence did come in, that's true.
All right.
So, the other part of the problem, I think, with my next issue is the admission of then Mr. Ruth's expert testimony as exhibits. And I think that's clearly improper hearsay, which shouldn't have been admitted. Basically, he was allowed, it'd be the same as allowing his opinion of what those things were to go back as a transcript of testimony. And in this case, I think that was improper because basically he's saying location, likely speed, and then causation of the accident through all those exhibits which came together then to come in and show who was responsible, which is a big issue in this case of responsibility and timing and those kind of things. So I think
how,
it would have been
how much of those exhibits were calculations and how much of it was opinion?
Well, the calculations are opinion because he's having to use a range and that's his interpretation of what the range should be, what the skid formula should be, how they should be applied, where it was, what the inclines were, all those other things. So there was a mix of both, I agree, but the one exhibit I remember specifically is this is where he is and this is how fast he's going. This is where he is and this is how fast he's going. And it's putting it all the way up to the scene of the accident. And I think that carried potentially a lot of weight without any of the cross-examination of the issues and problems with that exhibit. I'll reserve my remaining time.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Wells?
My name is Austin Relf. I represent the state of Nebraska. I'll just jump right into the issues that were the focus of my opponent's argument, starting first with the discovery issue. And basically, as I set forth in my brief, I think if there is a discovery violation, then the district court's order was proper. And the reason for that is because the statute allowing for the district court to create a remedy is pretty open-ended. Specifically, 29-1919 allows the court to issue an order, grant a continuance, order such party to permit the discovery, prohibit the party from calling a witness not disclosed, or, in our case, enter such other order as it deems just under the circumstances. And my position in brief and today is that there was a discovery violation, basically because the district court, in response to the defendant's request for discovery, which was open-ended, granted an open-ended discovery order, basically pursuant to statute. Under 1912, that included the names of the witnesses that was not disclosed until just before trial. And so to remedy that, the district court decided, well, here's a couple options that we can do. And I think that was allowed under 1919. Regardless, I think overall, there was no harm, even if there was error. As I said in my brief, I think a review of the exhibit, I believe it was Exhibit 161, was the paragraph description of a lot of testimony given to the state. Spoke in generalities, it was vague, didn't really tell much beyond what I think they already could have discerned from the CV. He was going to talk about the data master, about BAC levels. And that being the case, and I think it's also supported by what happens during trial. As I mentioned, there's a couple instances there, in particular the prosecutor indicating he has no idea what the witness is going to testify to in response to William's attorney, and then also that he didn't really have anything in response prepared for cross-examination or rebuttal testimony, and I think that's apparent from reading the record. So, in sum, basically, I think there was a discovery violation. Because there was a discovery violation, the court had broad discretion in formulating a remedy. He did that. It was proper. And in the alternative, I think there was harmless error, basically because what the defense was required to disclose did not affect his preparation and didn't aid the state based on what was provided. Moving to the expert testimony issue, I guess I didn't really see it as hearsay being offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted with these exhibits. It was more the witness going through his calculations, explaining his testimony to the jury. And I guess I don't see anything wrong with that. The Nebraska Supreme Court, I cited a 2018 decision, seems to suggest that in that situation, those exhibits are not offered to prove the truth of the matter, but simply to demonstrate the basis for the expert's testimony. That's what he was doing. He certainly had the ability to testify to every single item in those exhibits. He basically did, going through his calculations, his reasons for the assumptions he made, and his conclusions as well. And so I don't see any error in admitting those exhibits to basically describe his testimony to the jury so that they can understand it. Alternatively, again, I think any error there was harmless. This court's decision, State v. Medina, I think supports that, where, again, they brought in evidence of Hennecke scores, which was a scientific fact in the reports. They admitted that into evidence, and this court basically said, well, even if it was error, they had the ability to testify to that.
Should those exhibits have been received as substantive exhibits or as demonstrative exhibits?
Well, I don't know that there's one way or the other that it had to be done. I think if I were the prosecutor, I would have done it as demonstrative exhibits. I think that works the best under Pangborn. It certainly still wouldn't have changed anything. It would still go back to the jury. And so I guess I don't see, again, any harm coming from that.
There may have been more of a limiting instruction in that case if they were admitted as demonstrative exhibits.
Perhaps, yes. But I don't think the jury's use of them is going to change. Their focus is going to be on the conclusions of the testifying witness because his calculations are pretty pretty complicated. I don't think that they're looking at these exhibits to check the math. They're looking at them basically as he's testifying, and when he says he was going between, I forget the exact numbers, but around 90 miles an hour at this point, accelerator's fully depressed, etc., that's the focus of the jury, I think. And so I don't see any harm from them being admitted as substantive versus demonstrative I don't really think that there's an issue doing it substantively either. But like I said, I think it would have been easier just to do them as demonstrative exhibits on the hanging board.
And wasn't there other evidence of excessive speed beyond the expert's testimony and these exhibits?
Absolutely. I mean, the car was basically torn in half. It was about a block, city block, 400 feet, based on my recollection, between the truck, which had flipped on its side at the Blondo intersection, and the car at Parker. So just the distance, the amount of damage, the injuries to the individuals, I think clearly indicated that it was an extremely high-speed collision. So putting aside the specifics that the expert had, I do agree with you that the fact that it was a high-speed collision was apparent from other sources of evidence.
What about the pre-Miranda statements that were made in the police car?
Again, kind of relying on this harmless error type standard for a number of
people.
Seems
to be a theme here.
Sure. It is a theme. But, a defendant is not entitled to a perfect trial. They're entitled to a fair and constitutional trial. I think that's what he got. That has also been reiterated time and again by our court, the Supreme Court, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court. And the fact is that those statements that came in were cumulative of other things that he said to his wife in the jail phone calls that are apparent from other evidence about the high speed of the collision. And so I don't see any error there from the statements offered in the cruiser.
But you don't dispute that he was in custody at the time that the questions were asked and the answers were given?
Yes. I believe the prosecutor was relying on an exception, at least in their view, on the scene questioning type thing. That's for people that are not in custody. So I don't see any way that it wouldn't be considered interrogation when they're asking what happened.
What's your best argument? I mean, the events, once the police officers arrived, all happened quickly. There was just a few minutes passed before Mr. Williams was in custody. What's your best argument that there was probable cause to arrest at the point at which the arresting officer made the arrest?
Well, really, I think a lot of information that came out would have been apparent from their arrival on the scene. As we talked about, the high speed of the collision, I think, would have been apparent based on the damage, the distance between the vehicles.
People saw a fireball.
Yeah, I mean, testimony that there was a fireball that rose above the tree line. Numerous witnesses testified that there were beer cans strewn across the roadway. Ice.
He claimed those were not his, right?
Right, he did. But the ice and the beer cans led back to the truck based on the testimony. Witnesses identified him as the driver. He admitted that he was the driver before the arrest to the officer. The officer also said that he had, let me get it correct here, a strong odor of alcoholic beverage about him, had watery eyes, thicker, slowed speech, all of which indicated impairment. So I think you've got a high-speed collision. You've got the guy you know as the driver. You've got apparent alcohol involved. An impaired driver has plenty to arrest. And like I said in brief, I don't think he disputes, even if there wasn't probable cause to arrest, doesn't dispute that he had enough to be detained. And within 30 seconds of the time of arrest, they probably would have come up with that information, and then there's certainly probable cause to arrest then. So I don't know how inevitable discovery doctrine would not apply, even if the timing of the arrest was off by, say, 30 seconds, 60 seconds. Unless this court has further questions, submitted on the brief.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you.
And how much time do we have left for Mr. Island? Okay. And I'm going to give you another 30 seconds for my speech on the first part, Mr. Island.
Okay.
So.
Go ahead. I want to talk about the probable cause. They can't use facts obtained after the arrest in order to justify it. And if you look at the evidence, it was the bloodshot, watery eyes, not verified by the actual evidence, the booking photo, slurred speech, not verified by the evidence, the audio. So all we have is the smell of alcohol. That might be enough for reasonable suspicion, I think, in some way.
What about leaving the scene of the accident? Wasn't there testimony from, weren't the officers told, or the arresting officer told that that the driver of the pickup had walked away in the opposite direction of the accident?
But that's specifically contradicted because he's walking from the vehicle that was hit. So that
but
person...
But that's sometime afterwards.
No, it's right... He says, we saw him run off. There he is, walking from the car that had just been hit up to the police officer and walking right up to the police officer for the contact.
But wasn't there a period of time that elapsed from the accident before any officer arrived?
I'm sure there was. It takes time to respond. But there's nothing... That evidence is actually rebutted by actual physical evidence on the scene. So that's not a reliable statement. And there is some chaos. I understand why people might make a mistake. So...
Right.
I think you said you had 30 seconds.
I'm giving you an extra 30
oh,
seconds.
Oh, I apologize.
Yeah. Use it wisely.
The only other thing I can think of, what their statement seems to be is the old odd couple thing about assume. They want you to assume there was no impact by knowing this information about Dr. Milano. They want you to assume that there was no errors committed, and they want you to assume that everything is harmless error, which keeps amounting to error. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case